Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey everyone, and welcome to Pixels, a podcast for the discerning gamer. Hello everyone, and welcome to Pixels. This is a show where we cover the news from the video games industry. We talk about games on PC, on consoles, on laptops, on mobile, on everything there is, even on Alexa sometimes. Well, not really, but apparently there are Alexa games. Why not? You know, quizzes. What?
You can actually do the Skyrim thing on Alexa, can't you?
I believe you can, yes.
I don't know how good it is.
Probably. Well, so first of all, I'm Patrick Beja. This right here is Terpster, Mark.
Hello,
Terpster everyone. Turpin. How's it going?
It's going well, thank you, Patrick. How's it going for you?
It is going very well. Do you know why? Can you guess why my life has been enlightened with brilliance?
Oh, is it because you found a little ghost and you've gone on magical adventures across the solar system?
That is absolutely the case. I have found my love again for Destiny 2 in the trash bin of last year where I threw it after only like 80 hours of gameplay, which was ridiculous for Destiny 2. This new expansion had been hyped up by a lot of people who had been playing it, including yourself, Terpster.
Yes.
And you didn't like Destiny 1, or you didn't really play it.
So I played Destiny 1 a bit on Xbox, and if I have to play a game only on a console, I end up not playing it much. Most of my gaming time comes during the day when I'm at work. I'm like backwards to a lot of people. So like lunchtime and stuff like that, I can just fire up a game. And having it on a console at home and then, you know, not being able to kind of access it as easily, friends not really being around to play with, I just didn't really get into it. I could see that there was something there, but it just kind of just didn't really capture me.
And I guess you were part of the people who didn't re-up for the initial expansion back in, what was it, 2014?
Oh, what, Taken King? Or
yeah.
What are you talking about?
Taken King.
Yeah. So Taken King, when that came out, everyone was like, oh, it's amazing now. And I was like, it's too late.
I've already tried it.
I feel like it's passed
it,
me by. Exactly.
It's on PC. We're going to talk about it quite a bit. So we're going to get into that in just a moment. We're also going to be talking about the Oculus Quest, the new standalone VR headset, bunch of news from the Tokyo Game Show. We have, other tidbits as well. And also, before we get to Destiny 2, I do want to talk about a few very, very important bits of news from Sony, which actually are very interesting for the entire industry and not just PlayStation, because it might open up things. You might have heard already by now that Sony is introducing crossplay into their system. Now, famously, a few months ago, when Fortnite launched on Switch, people realized that they couldn't use their Fortnite account on the Switch if they had already linked it to their PlayStation account, which was outrageous, and people were outraged, and I was outraged as well.
You being outraged, Patrick. I'll be honest with you.
You know, it doesn't
such
happen
a calm
often.
Man. No.
It doesn't happen often, and especially in gaming and tech, but mostly gaming, where there's a lot of anger and outrage. I tend to think that the outrage is misplaced or at least exaggerated, and that constructive criticism is more effective. In this case, I thought it was necessary.
I thought it was complete bullshit. What the hell's going on, Sony?
I thought it was extremely anti-consumer, and I understand why they didn't want to allow crossplay and cross progression, which is the even more important part of it. So, just to clarify, crossplay means being able to play in a game with people from another platform. So being able to play with your friends on Xbox if you're using a PlayStation. That was not possible. It was possible on PlayStation with PC and on and mobile. And on Xbox and Switch, it was possible with everything except PlayStation, which was a very convoluted system. The reason being, Sony didn't want to allow this because they wanted to limit as much as possible, from what we understand. They didn't spell it out exactly, but they didn't want to enable the possibility for people to go buy items in the games they would play on other platforms and be able to use them on PlayStation 4. Reason being, it would be when it's the same price everywhere, it doesn't necessarily matter. But if you're the underdog, like Microsoft in this generation of consoles, you might sell things at a lower price to lure people in. And if you have a deal on some pack on Fortnite, then you encourage people to go and buy them in your store instead of the store in which they're going to use it, which is the Sony store. So,
I mean, we see it happen in Hearthstone. So Hearthstone has pricing that's higher on mobile because of Apple's 30% Apple tax. So it's cheaper to buy stuff on Battle.net. And actually then it's sometimes cheaper to buy it on Amazon, on Android, because they do promotions around Amazon coins, these gold currency that you can spend on in-game items. So people end up buying packs through Hearthstone through either emulators or Android devices to get more packs.
Yeah, and, it's by people you mean you.
Well, I do. I mean gamers. Gamers, we game things.
Yeah.
We want to find the way to break the system to our advantage, and that's part of the fun.
Yeah,
equally, and one of the big problems in the past with crossplay has always been, what about if the players had a better performance, or you know, they could play to a higher ability on your competitor's product? So all of a sudden, if the Xbox was better than the PlayStation when it came to playing at the high end, you know, it had less lag, input lag, it had better aim assist or whatever, people would play on Xbox. The second you put up console gamers against PC gamers, you've got mouse and keyboard versus controller. Mouse and keyboard is better when it comes to aiming. So,
which is why I think cross play is going to be relatively limited. So actually, what they announce is they are going to introduce cross play and cross progression. And the first game, it's starting in beta form with Fortnite, which is obviously the one that everyone is talking about. They're going to enable it for select partners, is the way they're phrasing it. So my suspicion is that they are charging the partner somehow to enable crossplay on their platform. And obviously, they are the big dog this generation. They are outselling the Xbox significantly. And so it makes sense that they would want to preserve their competitive advantage in that way. I'm guessing they're either getting a lump sum from the company that wants to enable crossplay on their platform, on PlayStation, or it's even possible that there is some convoluted system where anyone using an item on the Sony system that hasn't been purchased on a Sony system, then Sony gets a little bit of money for that. It seems a little bit convoluted, but maybe. I'm guessing mostly it, and we don't know that they're getting money, but it seems likely. That's what I would guess. And so not everyone is going to want to enable crossplay, but most of the games that need to, I'm guessing, are going to do that. And again, the really interesting thing is cross progression. So cross progression is not playing against someone on another, or with actually someone on another platform. It's just having a character that you level up on one platform be usable on the other platform. So basically, your account is the same everywhere, just like it is for Hearthstone, as you described. And so that would apply to Fortnite. You have the same account. That is way more important than crossplay, in my opinion. And that is obviously also being
Less onerous on the game platform.
Right.
Like, they don't have to worry about, oh, hang on, you know, what's happening here or there as much. Obviously, if they're getting a cut of in-game sales, which they do, then there is still the concern around, hang on, what about the premium we make off of your in-game transactions?
Exactly, yeah.
As you said earlier, but it's certainly not as much of an ask. You know, Blizzard do it well, but at the same time still have region locking. So, you know, our EU accounts are different from our NA accounts. So, you know, even companies that do it well still find ways to do it badly.
I really hope at some point it's going to go away.
I doubt it. I don't think there's enough of a really? Noise. It's more of a general kind of frustration. And they know they make it easier and all the rest. Anyway, so crossplay, I'm excited to see more crossplay and cross progression. It is what consoles need, especially as we kind of start going through kind of new iterations. New generations, you know, the fact that Skyrim's available on every single platform, I'd love to be able to play my character, you know, on them all, rather than each time making it new. The big one again for me is Diablo 3 now coming out on Switch.
If they enable it there,
you've got to start all over again, is fine.
That is,
and the way they look at it is people play Diablo based on seasons now. People don't play the campaign.
That's true.
And so, you're starting a new character every 4 months anyway, so what's the big deal?
Well, I mean, for the people who are still playing, it's not necessarily a big deal. I think a lot of people who haven't been playing might get it on Switch if they can use their old character. The people who haven't played for a year or two might fire it up again, especially if they announced a new Diablo game, the excitement would be. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Another game which I would love for them to enable this for, obviously, is Destiny, which has been on my mind very much in the past couple of weeks. And I mean, beyond this, it's just revolutionizing the way we approach games in general, I think, because your game is not the thing you purchase on a platform, that your game is your account in the cloud that is beamed down on whatever platform you happen to purchase.
But I mean, Destiny's an interesting example, though, in that you play it on PlayStation, don't you?
Yeah, yeah.
You actually have exclusive stuff I don't have. So you have access to a strike early. I don't get that yet. You have like a fusion rifle, I think, or something like that, like a void laser fusion rifle thing. And I don't get those. So I don't know if they did put something like crossplay into Destiny, how do you handle, like, if you have that gun, do you just not have it if you log in on PC?
That's true. That might also be part of their, monetization scheme that might be problematic. But actually, if you have it, it means you have paid Sony for the game on their platform.
Yeah, I guess so.
Because obviously
you have to buy it.
Is
on PlayStation.
Exactly. Yeah. So you use it on PC, but you have it because you've played on PlayStation. So it's also kind of advertisement for the thing.
I wonder if you could make really good weapons then, because it's like, well, everyone can get them. You just have to spend an extra $60. Also buy it on PlayStation. I'm sure that could
get people who want to play on Xbox to buy it on PlayStation and get that thing and then get back to
then
their
they get God of War and they get all the other ones. Yeah, yeah. No, exactly. I could see that being an interesting
could be a blessing in disguise
issue.
For Sony. Yeah, I mean, the strike obviously is not going to be usable. I guess, but anyway, we'll see how they do all of this. I am really looking forward to, because I'm not playing on PC. I didn't buy it on PC because I've been playing for years at this point, even if I didn't keep my Destiny 1 character on PlayStation. And I mean, there are tons of games, Overwatch, there are a ton of games where you will be encouraged to buy the game multiple times because you want to play it on different platforms. And this is the way games are today. And for free-to-play games, obviously, it's not the same issue at all. But for pay game, and It arrived through the free-to-play games because that is Fortnite's power to make that much noise. But I think it's going to affect almost every game in the industry. And that is really bringing this decision by Sony that finally relented and agreed to make it happen is going to unlock essentially crossplay for everything everywhere, I think.
How is Nintendo in the progressive side of this? But Nintendo historically is always the sluggish, like, hey,
well, actually,
yeah, we're gonna do it the old way.
No, they made a joint advertisement with Microsoft saying you can play I think it was Minecraft.
Yeah,
play together was their shtick. So they are completely open to it. And so we essentially have no platform now where you can't do crossplay anymore and cross progression. So I think it's going to be beneficial for every game, every gamer. And everyone's going to be buying games on multiple platforms, I suppose. Sure. That's the big news for me. There is also a name change coming very soon. We remember Sean Layden, I think, discussing it at PlayStation Experience last year, and he said, my hope is that by next year's PlayStation Experience, you will not have to ask me that question again of when it is coming. And they are not doing a PlayStation Experience this year, so very smart, Sony. They're not going to have to do it.
Never going to do it again.
It's pretty good. They don't need to do a PlayStation Experience if they don't have anything to talk about. I think that is smart. Don't raise expectations and then not deliver. That is the worst thing you could do. They are on track with everything, and that's a little bit disappointing, but whatever. There will be the Game Awards that will give us an opportunity for excitement in December. What else? Sony is coming up with the PlayStation Classic, which is their version of the retro console HDMI enabled with 20 games, I think, for $100. Are you excited about this?
Not really, no. I had the PlayStation 1, the PS1, and I was, you know, but I'm kind of done with this style of product. You know, I didn't really get excited for the SNES Mini or the NES Mini and stuff, and I played on it.
It's not so much that you're done with them, it's that you never were excited at all, like me.
I think, for me, I want to play new games.
Yeah.
I've played old games, and my experience, because I've had these consoles and I've kept them, and then I've plugged them in, and I've realized after about 10, 15 minutes, the fun's gone. Mm. The nostalgia washes away, and you realize, actually, these aren't that good. If they were good, they've been iterated on further and made into even better versions in other games.
Mm. Yeah. I get the nostalgia. I think it's almost a series of collector's items. Someone said it, I can't remember who it was, but thinking of it as something you display in your home or whatever to showcase your love of these things. And when I look at it like that, I almost want them, not to play them, but just to have them as, you know,
as collector pieces.
Yeah.
And I can see, like, the advantage of them having HDMI output and stuff.
Yeah,
like that. You know, to be able to plug it into modern stuff and be able to consume that content legally.
But you never
I can see the advantage. But if I'm sitting down in front of my TV to play a game, I'm going to play a good game. Like a new game, one that's, you know, I don't see people saying, like, I'm not going to pick up Destiny 2 or Black Ops 4. I'm going to go play, the original Tekken.
Tekken 7.
Play the new Tekken.
It's true. I mean, I can see, obviously, nostalgia, but that's always the case. Some people love them. More power to you, so you'll be able to buy the PlayStation Classic with the terrible 3D graphics that age so much worse than 16-bit graphics. 8-bit, you know, I don't really love. 16-bit is still nice, but 3D doesn't age well.
32-bit 3D. Enjoy it, guys.
PlayStation Now, last bit of Sony news. PlayStation Now is now enabling the possibility to download the game to your console. As you know, PlayStation Now is the streaming service from Sony that has a collection of 600 games now. Pretty extensive. Obviously, if you don't have a good connection, it's challenging. But you can now download most of the PlayStation 4 games and PlayStation 2 remastered games on your console physically, just like you can on the Xbox Game Pass. The difference is, so they have a lot more games than the Xbox Game Pass, I think. And you can choose whether to stream or to download, but obviously they don't have the recent games. You have like 2 years lag, I guess, between the games that come on PlayStation Now, and even not all of them come out on PlayStation Now, whereas on the Xbox Game Pass you get many, many last generation very recent games day and date with the release for first party games, for the Microsoft games. Of course there aren't as many, so it's really a different kind of offering.
Quality over quantity, depending on your perspective.
I mean, the quality, there are some great games on PlayStation Now, it's just not the latest ones.
Is that you can download them so you avoid the bandwidth fluctuation,
exactly,
of quality of video and stuff.
Yeah.
So a friend of mine runs a product called Polystream, and it's one of those cloud gaming services. But what they do that's different, that I don't think PlayStation Now does, I think the way PlayStation Now works is that there's basically a unit in the cloud that's playing it and streaming it to you.
Oh, I'm sure it's servers, but yeah.
So the way that the Polystream works is that they send the instructions to your GPU. So the kind of the CPU's in the cloud, and it uses your local GPU to render and output and do all of that.
Oh,
so it's much lower bandwidth, higher quality experience, lower latency, all the rest, and infinitely more plausible in today's cost of, if you've got to buy a load of PlayStations to put in the cloud so that people can play on their PlayStations, seems crazy.
So
I don't know if PlayStation Now renders locally or externally.
No, it renders externally. You can play it on PC, actually. PlayStation Now, you can play on PC. You don't need anything. So Polystream actually just sends it. It doesn't render. It doesn't send video. It sends instructions for
your graphics card. So if you have a really good graphics card, you're going to get a nicer look. But the thing is it's all about the now. You know, you haven't got to download the game, install the game, all the rest. You just run the game.
Yeah, and it's interesting, but you still need the graphics card to render it. So
yeah, I mean, their argument is that gamers tend to have those.
Right. So it's a different.
They got it. I saw them. I don't think this is NDA'd. I'm going to say it anyway. I saw them having The Witcher 3 in 4K running off of an Xbox One. And as much as you can, you know, it was the PC version on the Xbox, like all streamed and stuff. I was like, this is crazy. This is like, you know, black magic.
So it can do it better than you could do if everything was rendered locally, is what you're saying?
In theory, yeah, because you can take
part of the computing power outside of
the computing power out of it. And equally then you can have a huge amount more units. Because in theory, I used to work on live like eight years ago, whatever. Mm. And the way that works is if you wanted to play, it's basically there was a, you know, not 4K, but a 4K gaming rig in the cloud for every person that pressed the button saying they wanted to play the game.
Yeah. And that's why
it had to be close to those people so that the latency was low enough that it worked.
That's how Shadow PC works and PlayStation Now. And exactly. I'm guessing they have, you know, virtualized devices, but they still need a device per stream.
Huge amount of hardware and cost per person. And it's the sort of thing like, by the sounds of things, now I've seen this technology working. If this can be spun out more, if they can make it cheaper, then you reduce the cost, meaning you can put that investment into titles and other stuff.
That's really interesting, because obviously we've heard about Xbox Scarlett, which is the next project from Microsoft, the next console, and it's going to be half physical, half streaming, with some portions of the GPU computing, or of the computing being done locally to reduce lag. There's hit detection, prediction, and stuff like that that they were talking about. I don't know enough technically to know how these things work, but it seems there's some products that already do something somewhat kind of a little bit similar. So that's really interesting. So,
yeah, I find I just find it really exciting, cloud gaming. Mm. It's that whole thing of like, if you wanted to play World of Warcraft today, currently you have to download, you know, a portion of the game. It's not the whole thing, the way they've got their streaming client set up, but you still have to download something, install it, wait a bit, load up. Whereas with these, you know, cloud gaming services, you can click and you're in.
Yeah.
And I think that what free-to-play gave to games was it removed the obstacle of cost in terms of, well, you can just try it, see if you like it. And if you do, yeah, there's going to be in-game transactions there that will slowly milk you dry. But, you know, it removed the initial hurdle. And I think if they can take that further with cloud gaming to do that for premium products and free products, whereby you can just jump straight in, you know, no install, no wait, just straight in. That, I think, kind of just explodes out games even further, just grows the industry. Exciting times. Holy crap.
It will be interesting to follow in the future. But you know what is interesting to follow now?
Destiny 2 Forsaken.
Exactly. There you go. I knew you were going to catch that. So Destiny 2 Forsaken. Let's recap very quickly what happened over the past year or so. Destiny 2 came out, and it was great for the leveling up process. Now, the campaign wasn't as awesome, I think, as many people were saying. I thought it was average. But the real issue with Destiny 2 was that the end game content wasn't super developed, wasn't super fantastic. It was actually very problematic, and I'll come back to that later. So what I did was that I played for about 80 hours, as I mentioned, and then stopped, whereas Destiny 1 basically ate my life for 2 years. And it was a little bit of a disappointment. I really enjoyed these initial 80 hours, and I actually thought it was a great... There were great additions from Destiny 1 to Destiny 2, and a lot of interesting gameplay mechanics and activities, and a lot of corrections from the issues of Destiny 1, but that end game was really problematic. So that was my issue with Destiny 2 Vanilla. I could go into a whole dissertation about the whole thing, but that was the main one. And I was very angry with Bungie and Activision because I didn't buy the two mini expansions from last year, and they told me if I want to play Forsaken, the big expansion from this year, that I had to buy these other two. And I didn't want to because I would obviously skip over them and just rush to the new stuff, and I didn't want to pay for something I wouldn't use. But two things happened. First, not exactly. First, everyone who I trust and love has been telling me that Forsaken is really doing for Destiny 2 what the Taken King did for Destiny 1, meaning make it great again. I could have said what Donald Trump is doing for America, but, you know, I'm keeping it in game.
It's really good. And equally, Destiny wasn't as great as it is now. So it genuinely has made it great.
I mean, I love Destiny 1. Well, but yeah, you're right. Destiny 1 was...
I think the thing is if you look at The Division, Destiny 2, I'm trying to think of another kind of game.
For Honor, Siege.
I mean, yeah, Rainbow Six Siege. We had a whole host of AAA titles that came out unfinished. And they didn't want to use the term early access, which the kind of indie AAA scene has been using now. So we kind of buy it and we expect, all right, yeah, this is going to get better. We expected the product to be complete. And they sold it as such. And
I would dispute that, honestly, in the case of Destiny. It was a complete product. It was just, it had issues. It had very big issues. Well, I mean, maybe it wasn't finished in the sense that it wasn't polished. They didn't look at it seriously. But the big problems with Destiny 1 were the campaign, really. It was, I mean, no, the big problem with Destiny 1 was that it wasn't what people thought it was going to be. It wasn't a big MMO. It was really a multiplayer shooter. That's what it was.
Yeah.
And people thought it was going to be this grand space adventure. And the lore and storytelling around it was, first of all, very poor, but it was also just a wrapper around great shooting mechanics. And now, to be fair, Destiny 2 didn't really fix that entirely. As I mentioned, some people said Destiny 2 was great, had a great campaign. It really wasn't. It was average. It was okay.
I need my fire team. that's yeah.
Is you that your Zavala?
That's my Zavala. That's good. Good. That's a good Zavala.
So, okay, I didn't want to pay for all of this, but everyone has been telling me Destiny 2 Forsaken is great. And I found a collection of, like, Legendary Collection, which includes everything, for the price of just Forsaken. And I was always happy to pay Forsaken, I just didn't want to pay for the other two expansions, Warmind, Osiris and Warmind. Yeah.
Curse of Osiris, yeah.
Yeah. And so essentially I didn't. I got them for free because I got the full thing for just the price of Forsaken. So I figured, you know, I buy it, I plug it in, I'm going to play through Osiris and Warmind, and I did. And Osiris was pretty terrible. Warmind was just terrible, not, you know, it was pretty bad.
Have you done the Sleeper Simulant quests?
No, I didn't.
So that's the thing. So Warmind did introduce some really fun MMO-esque style things. And equally, have you got Whisper of the Worm?
No.
So Whisper of the Worm is the point, in my opinion, where Destiny 2 went from a good game to a legendary game. They introduced a weapon. Is it the Black Spindle in Destiny 1?
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember the name. Yeah. So basically, they brought that back in the shape of the Whisper of the Worm. So it's an exotic sniper rifle that has a trait where if you nail 3 precision shots, it refills the mag. So just out of nowhere. So you can basically just chain precision hit enemies. So if you're doing a big raid boss where they've got a huge precision like headshot style mechanic for one of their phases, you whack out this gun and just bang 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 bang, and it is the best weapon in the game. So it's really cool. But what made it special is how you get it. So on a weekend, has to be a weekend, a world event will spawn on the planet Io, and at the same time of that, in another location on Io, a taken boss will spawn. And again, none of this is documented. Hey, go to Io and kill this. It just happened. You then kill this guy.
None of this is documented, you said. You cut off for a second.
Sorry, none of this is documented. It's not part of the game. No quest guys told to go there. You know, Zavala's not said, hey, there's a taken incursion on Io. So you just you go out there, you kill this guy, a portal opens, you go through, and then you're in this area, and a timer is just counting down from 20. And people basically explored around, and then they found there was this little hole with a little kind of taken fissure over it. They shot, they fell down, and then there's this huge jumping puzzle that they went through, and they found their way through. And then once they got to the end of this like labyrinth style maze, they found 3 bosses, and they're really, really hard. And then you kill these 3 bosses, and it drops the Whisper of the Worm, this exotic sniper rifle. And then you also unlock a heroic version of that you can enter at any point, and you have to go through and complete the catalyst where you have to find chests, and you can also get a ship
Let me interrupt you for a second there, because I think a lot of the listeners are a little bit lost.
They're zoned out. So apologies. Basically, what I'm saying is they introduce game mechanics like vanilla Warcraft, whereby I didn't read about it. Well, you do now read about it on like Wowhead, but the game had emergent story and fun and quests. It was accessible to everyone. You didn't need to be playing the end game raid at the time to be able to get this weapon. You just needed to be able to discover it, find it. It caused people to talk in game and group up socially. And, you know, be like, hey, I know what to do. I'll tell you what, you come with me. I'll guide you through the labyrinth and we'll do that together. It just was beautiful.
It's just funny because...
So fantastic.
What you're describing... So Destiny was always a great shooter, had great mechanics. I've said it a million times. What you're describing is the incredible achievement of Destiny 1, The Taken King. It was amazing. There was so many things like that in that game. And it motivated the community. Everyone was talking about it. Everyone was excited. We were exploring together. And you had these challenges that were super hard and you had to investigate. It was like, it was honestly a new era of gaming secrets to be explored by the community. And the tragedy is that they had developed this product with Destiny 1, The Taken King, that was very balanced. You had great gameplay, great engagement. It was still dumb for the story, but it was fun to play. And Destiny 2 Vanilla basically abandoned all of this. There were no exciting secrets, no gameplay loop that would keep you in the game for a long time. Their cardinal sin was, we are going to make this game, you know, playable for 4 hours a week. You can finish what you have to do in 4 hours a week. And it was an intentional design intent, you know? It was like, the issue with Destiny 1 was that people were spending so much time in it that it was too much of a commitment and normal people couldn't play it. So we're going to do the same game, but you just have 4 hours worth of stuff to do to get upgrades. Everything after that, you can still play, but you don't get upgrades. And of course, since this is a simile MMO type thing, you're always chasing the next item level thing that is going to make you progress. And they have gotten back to that in a big way with Destiny 2 Forsaken. And actually, before I get to that, I do have to add, there's one thing which I think people are going to be wondering. If you've never played Destiny 1, if you've never cared, and you don't want to play, is it worth doing for the campaign? And no. I have never enjoyed the campaigns in any Destiny game. As I said, Destiny 1 was ridiculous. The Taken King was okay, but it was like 5 hours or 10 hours maybe, and it was not that great. It was nice. Destiny 2 was really very average. The campaign was never what you got from Destiny. In Destiny 2, it is great.
Forsaken.
In Destiny 2 Forsaken, yes, yes. Yeah. In Destiny 2 Forsaken, the campaign is really well written. It is engaging. It is fun. And not only is it a great solo campaign, it weaves in parts of the solo game, because previously you did the solo campaign, which was essentially you do missions one after another and you're playing alone. Maybe at some point you will, you know, see other people around you, but like that's bubbles, it. You're playing alone. Yeah. But you just essentially rush through the multiplayer portions. In Forsaken, they give you a lot of stuff to do that forces you to take part into what is essentially the end game of Destiny. And so doing the campaign, which is quite long, I would say it's 15 hours maybe, something like that.
I'd say so. Actually, you go from level 30 to 50.
Yeah, and it takes a while.
Yeah, and previous expansions, you've gone from 20 to 25 to 25 to 30. This is 30 to 50. It's a big chunk of content.
And you get a sample of what the actual game is, including the end game. You play through those public events, and you do some patrols, and it kind of weaves you into all of this, and you are brought to those places, and you actually take part in it. For the first time ever, I would recommend a Destiny thing, even if you're only doing the campaign. It's brilliantly done. I love it.
You buy the game, you get a boost. It puts you to 30 and power level 320. So you can play straight away. If you played Destiny 1, you go to the Prison of Elders. So you got a great nostalgic kick right from the start. If you haven't played a Destiny game before, it doesn't matter. It will talk you through it. Basically, the campaign is a Wild West revenge story. And you feel like an outlaw going out and bringing justice to the frontier. And then it beautifully segues into a weird space wizard aliens don't quite understand other dimension thing, and still feels brilliant. It still feels like a fantastic progression of story. There's a raid that is really hard, but then there's strikes, there's heroic strikes, nightfall strikes, there's even a single player dungeon.
They're essentially dungeons.
Yeah, well, there's now a dungeon. They call it a dungeon, which is a single strike team, fire team raid. So a 1-3 player raid experience.
Oh, really? Which one is it?
Complicated mechanics. So it's where you get the new exotic bow, the Wishender. So it's got, I think, like 4 different bosses. But these bosses require you to be extremely competent, move, not just keep firing at a shield that says immune.
But wait, the Wishender, I've done a lot of things. You enter it like you would enter a strike?
So you know the idol you got to enter the Dreaming City?
Yes.
Of the spider. Yeah. So that idol is the start of the Wishender bow. And also what you'll notice around the Dreaming City are all of these Amankara or Taken Eggs, these weird sort of crystally things.
Say immune when you try to shoot them.
Exactly. The only weapon that can destroy those is the Wishender bow. So you have to go into this single player or single strike team dungeon.
No, but that's my point. Where is it? How do you get into it?
So it is, I think you have to use a tincture of Queen's
Fall. Oh, and wrong. Then you see the secret
I'm trying to remember. It's not listed on the maps or anything like that. Again, discovery, community, it's all of the brilliant things that an MMO an online multiplayer game should have.
And I would even argue, honestly, that what you just witnessed now was, you know, Terps are saying, oh, there's this thing, and you're like, oh, wait, how do you get it? Do you think it's here? Yes. And do you get it? And this is something that we never have quite had in that way in any game. And that was the brilliance of the Taken King, and it was so sad when it didn't come back in Destiny 2.
Design teams or studios do you think are involved in Destiny?
I think it's just one. It's other. Nope. Well, I mean, there are a couple of teams. There's a live team.
No. There's 3 different studios.
Oh,
it's not just Bungie. There are literally 3, at least, maybe even more, different studios involved in this, and there is a live team, and there is a team I'm sure that's working on Destiny 3.
Right,
But there's lots of different companies and teams and expertise that are all getting wrangled together back at Bungie's HQ. And it's not to say that the launch team is crap, and the live team come along, and the Taken King guys are back. The Taken King guys made the beginning of Destiny 2.
Exactly. That's why I was saying it was design intent. It wasn't, that's what I thought at first, maybe, but it was really clear, we found out, that they wanted the game to become more casual. And in doing that, they essentially didn't really attract the casual players and lost many of the hardcore players. But it was just a bad decision. It's easy to decide now, to realize now that it was a bad decision. But at the time, it could have made sense. I think it was really a bad decision. But this kind of engagement, I almost never see anywhere. Maybe in WoW. And a lot of WoW's, Legion secrets... There was a lot of secrets that engaged the community in that expansion. I really think it was inspired by the way it was done with Destiny's The Taken King.
No doubt.
And so the campaign is really great. But after you're done with the campaign, you still feel like you have stuff to do. And beyond that, I joked about it on Twitter earlier, Destiny 2 is essentially a giant to-do list. More than that, it's like overlapping to-do lists of different kinds. There are like 4 different kinds of to-do lists that each overlap with one another, and every time you accomplish one of the items, it checks a box in like 3 different things you have to do. So there's this feeling of I'm accomplishing stuff all the time.
Efficiency. Yeah, exactly. I've done really well on this one as well.
And all of the items, actually, 95% of the items are go shoot stuff, which is great because
the best bit
shooting
of the game.
Yeah, it's the best part of the game, shooting stuff. And it's never ending.
I think it's the one thing that kind of hurts it though at the same time, because I think people who like Destiny are people who like World of Warcraft. People who like World of Warcraft don't necessarily think of themselves as shooter fans because they think of Call of Duty. This isn't Call of Duty. This is Warcraft level of numbers and abilities and gearing and upgrades, coupled with an amazing, visceral, satisfying gameplay experience of shooting combat. And it really is just an amazing fusion of genres. And you can kind of see, like, back when Overwatch and Titan was going to be more MMO-y, like, could it have been like Destiny? Could they have made a game where you run around as a character like Tracer and also get gear and progression and upgrades and things like that? And you can see Destiny does that very well.
Very, very well. I agree. It is as satisfying to play as ever. The progression and the secrets are motivating. You always have something to do. You always have 15 things to do. You get, as I said, a great story and excitement for the future. And once you're done with a campaign, there are still so many things to do. And I mean, I'm not going to spoil anything, but it's, I didn't look at any video or anything before I played. And I was amazed at some of the things that I found after I did the campaign. So it is, the big question is,
you the end game area, you do not experience until after you have finish the campaign.
Right.
So where you'll spend the vast majority of your time is a whole extra thing that you didn't even know existed.
Right. Well, that's the thing I didn't want to spoil, but there you go. I guess you did. but it's a very tiny spoiler, and probably by now it's impossible to ignore. There is one issue potential issue, which is the annual pass, which you have to pay in one go if you want the updates for the whole year. And we don't know yet if they're going to be blocking, like if it's going to be a light level, a power level increase for your character. So if you don't have them, then you don't have access to the end game. We don't quite know yet, but I mean, for me, if you can get the Legendary Edition of Destiny 2 Forsaken, which is essentially everything that came before, I think it's worth it because the campaign alone is worth it. It's not the best game you've ever played, but it's such a fun experience for even if you just play for 20 hours. And then you get the end game. If you don't get the end game because the annual pass has, made that goalpost go a little bit farther, then it's your choice to pay more to get that. But we don't at this point. It's still extremely. There's nothing that's been added that changes that. But it doesn't really matter because for the first time in the history of that franchise, I would say the campaign alone is definitely worth the money for the full thing, especially if you pay, it's going to be $50 pretty soon, maybe even less. Absolutely worth it. 100%. I would. And beyond the campaign itself, I will say if you play through it, you will have a reasonable understanding of what Destiny is, which wasn't the case for the previous campaigns. It's a recommend for me.
Yeah, definitely. Stop listening now. Go get it.
even if people like, you also agree, even if it's just to play through the campaign, you would recommend it.
Yeah, no, 100%. But the thing is you won't stop at just the campaign.
Yeah,
it will win you over. Like, it is one of those games, once you play it and you get into it, you get it. And you're like, holy moly, why have I not been playing this already? It's really, really solid.
All right. Well, there you go. That is Destiny 2 Forsaken. Our impressions on that game, for me, surprisingly positive. I didn't think it was going to be that fun.
Yeah.
All right. Other tidbits of news. Oculus has announced the Oculus Quest, which is a standalone VR headset. Think of it as the Oculus Go, which is the cheaper version. The Oculus Go is about $250. But this one is $400. But my issue with the Oculus Go was that you didn't have 6 degrees of freedom, only 3 degrees. Essentially, what it meant was you couldn't move around. You could rotate, but not move from one place to another. And that is a huge problem for VR, because one of the key attractions, the key assets of VR technology is that you can move in a space. And the other thing was you couldn't use touch controllers. Essentially, the controller wouldn't move when you moved your hands, so you couldn't render your hands. The Oculus Quest does both of those things, and it is a standalone headset. You don't have to connect with long cables to your PC. The problem is, it is not high power enough to just play the Oculus games. So you will have to, or experiences, you will have to wait for those experiences to be ported specifically to the Oculus Quest. So I'm not sure yet if I could recommend this for people. We'll have to wait and see, I guess. If they develop the library quick enough, maybe. But it's still $400, which is not cheap. And you have to buy the controllers on top of that, I think.
Do you know what I find the biggest hurdle with VR is? And I don't know if this is just exclusively Europe, but certainly where I live, and it is play space. Like my house, right. I live in a reasonably nice house. It's got some room, some size. I mean, yeah, I've got kids, but like, you know, there's space. Is there enough space to play VR games? Not really. Like the amount of living space you need to give over to a setup to allow you to consume that, and then equally to obviously blindfold yourself. It doesn't really work. And I've been in the development studios where they make these games, and they have these huge caves set up as VR studios that they go in and test it in. And I'm like, this is bigger than my bedroom without any furniture in. And you're here like, oh, this is a great experience. I'm like, yeah, it is. But not in a home. Like, you know, all these people creating these experiences where it's like, yeah, you can move around, you can interact with stuff.
Well, my experience
with the sat down.
Yeah. My experience with the PSVR is it's doable if you're sitting down or just getting up and you move your table, you know, your coffee table around a little bit and you have enough space for that. But I think with a standalone headset that has no cable coming out of it and doesn't require, you know, cameras to be all around your room, I think it's much more doable for most people, including in our tiny European homes. So I think this is the direction to be going. But it's still a little bit expensive, and you have to add the cost of the controllers on top of that. And, I mean, we're getting apparently a Darth Vader experience, which is going to be developed by Ninja Theory. So that's a, you know, reliable studio. And it's going to be episodic and everything. So maybe that's going to be fun. But I'm still... The problem is, if you had told me the Oculus Quest can play all of the Oculus games, and, you know, sure, it has 2 hours of... Even if it has an hour and a half of battery life, no, it doesn't matter, because that is, the games are already there and ready and already proven, I might have gotten it. The fact that we need games to be ported for this, and it has the capabilities, roughly the power of the Xbox 360, PS3, it's not bad. I think it can create good experiences, but you're probably not going to get the experiences you wanted from even the PS4, like the PSVR. It's going to be less capable than those. So it's not about the visuals necessarily, because the Oculus Go visuals are okay. It's more about the fact that they need to be the games need to be ported to that platform. And it's going to be hard for many of those games. So I don't know what to... I don't think I'm recommending it. I'm not getting it, so... TGS, Tokyo Game Show, had a few bits of information. We got a new trailer for Death Stranding with Troy Baker playing another weird character monster thing. I mean, he was playing a character and there was a monster that he summoned. And we still don't know anything about the game. Excited?
Yes and no. In that I've enjoyed Hideo Kojima's previous work. I really liked Phantom Pain and the other Metal Gear Solid recently. I don't know. It looks really nice. It looks a little bit confusing, but then again, like if you created a cutscene with some Metal Gear Solid stuff out of context, you'd probably be like, "What the heck is this?"
Yeah.
But actually, when you play it, you understand it all.
I would say Death Stranding is more out there than Metal Gear Solid.
Yeah, it seems to be, but I think it's going to be like some sort of kind of stealth-based exploration delivery sim, whereby you have your extra life is a baby you carry around on your body or something like that.
That does not sound exciting at all to me, but you know what? Yeah. Maybe it's going to be fun. Puyo Puyo...
It looks nice, at least.
It looks very nice. I mean, I'm intrigued. I'll be honest. I'm more intrigued than when it first appeared on the scene. Puyo Puyo is getting an esports version, and that... Well, not an esports version. It's like a new game called Esports Edition or something like that. It led me to think... Why are puzzle games, Tetris-like games, not an eSport? It's like super easy to understand. It's impressive when you immediately when you look at it. It does require a huge amount of mastery. Puyo Puyo would make a great eSports. I
that's obviously what they're thinking.
It seems so, yeah. But so we'll see.
I have to see. I think it's a question of there's a lot of really fun games to play, a lot of fun sports to play that don't necessarily translate into terribly fun watching experiences.
But I think this one would. Don't you think so? Like a Puyo Puyo or a Tetris?
Yeah, maybe. Again, I don't know, really. It depends on what the kind of... I think if it's against other players, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, of course. That's the idea.
Yeah. But it needs to be... I don't know.
Yeah, it's probably not going to happen, but I just thought it could be fun.
Maybe. Castle,
are you ready for some super old school Castlevania games on your PlayStation 4?
No.
Oh, well, okay, then you don't care that on October 26th, Symphony of the Night and Rondo of Blood are coming to PS4. I'm excited. I'm a big Castlevania fan. I'll probably won't get it though. So
I don't think I will. The thing is,
a moment of honesty here just now, but
there's Fallout 76 betas coming out around that time, isn't it? And I just think likely playing that.
You know what else is coming out around that time?
What
is the biggest game of the year?
Oh, you're coming out of the closet at that time, and I salute you for that. It's great.
Game, not game.
Red Dead Redemption. Red Dead Redemption 2 is coming out, and that as well is going to dominate everyone's life.
Which, by the way, since we're moving on, they announced that they have an online version coming out in November as a public beta, so it's starting slowly. But Red Dead Redemption Online confirmed. It's not like we had any doubt. They've been making so much money with GTA Online. I wonder what it's going to look like, though. Is it going to be like everyone has their saloon base and dresses funny? And like, I don't know what Red Dead Online looks like.
Exactly. Are they going to have an update 4 years from now where we've got Robo Horse and Zombie Horse and all of that? Probably. I think if as long as they can keep the fun of online, then RDR2 online will be really, really strong.
But how does it even take shape? Like, do you go out and play missions?
They had online in Red Dead Redemption.
I forgot about
lots
that.
It was lots of kind of deathmatchy, shooty stuff. And you'd go in as a posse and clear out a load of NPC missions and stuff like that. I used to play it with Nicole back in the day.
Oh, wow.
I'm surprised we didn't invite you. That's really weird. I'm sure they can create some really fun online experiences. But for me, I love these games for their offline mode. And then it's the community. As long as they can create... The thing that keeps me playing GTA 5 online is the constant addition of community maps and challenges and modes. And, kind of... We
but
do
it just
playlists.
feels it just feels like a modern game is so much more, you know, possible to make into an online experience. For the Western, it would feel weird if you added, you know, I guess they can add new maps and missions, but it's just not, you can't add, as you said, robo horses.
But it's the furniture, exactly, and they can change it. And they can make it so that, you know, on GTA 5, we're going through these big jumps and speed boosts and stuff like that. You know, they can still have that on Red Dead Redemption on horses. You just kind of suspend your disbelief a bit, or they make
everything
out of
wood. Was there a zombie mode in Red Dead?
There was. They released a zombie DLC, didn't they?
I think so.
Yeah.
All right. Well, if you enjoy driving fast in GTA, you're probably going to enjoy Forza, and Forza Horizon 4 apparently is amazing. I was never into, you know, I haven't been into racing games for a long time, but I'm hearing only good things about Horizon 4. I mean, Forza in general is very highly regarded. Horizon is the very accessible version of that franchise, and 3 was already great, and it seems 4 is fixing everything, the small things that were not great with 3. So I guess it's a recommend. Everyone I've been hearing talking about it said it's great. So you can go check it out. Telltale is so sad. Did we talk about it last time? I don't think so. Essentially, Telltale has announced that they are, well, has laid off 90% of their staff. They have kept a very small staff on to finish up a few projects, not The Walking Dead initially. Now they are announcing that they might be able to finish The Walking Dead with partners, which the entire industry answered, don't think about finishing The Walking Dead. Think about severance for your employees that you just let go. I mean, obviously, looking at it from Europe, where we do have unemployment, you know, benefits, it's just sad to see how that works out every time. But the other thing is, Telltale is such a sad story of mismanaged success. As brilliant as Epic is in managing Fortnite, Telltale has had the world as its oyster on a platter, all the metaphors you can think of with the success of The Walking Dead initially a few years ago. And they squandered that opportunity in such a bad way. It was like everyone looking at it knew what was wrong. For real this time, not like every gamer knows what's wrong with every game and usually doesn't understand what's actually what that implies. In this case, everyone knew what the problems were and that they were taking on too much, not refreshing the engine, and they, the only people that didn't know seemed to be the people in charge of the company, and that was so sad. And we've come to the unavoidable conclusion that Telltale is not making enough money to keep going, and that's really sad.
It is. It's a real sad tale. And it is. I like those guys have made a fantastic game, and then they've kept making that same game now for near enough a decade.
And some versions were good. I mean, you know, the
sometimes the IP carried it, sometimes it didn't. I think it's just that the people who kind of don't get any of the credit for making those great experiences are the ones who get all of the brunt And with the biggest industry in the world when it comes to entertainment, bigger than, you know, movies and music combined, you know, games make a huge amount of money. However, that doesn't necessarily trickle down to the actual people who are actually making the games. So,
they're bad. There was a lot of discussions about unionization and defending. And it's true that an issue with the industry is that there are a lot of, I wouldn't say abuses, but not even unsavory. Like, it's extreme practices where crunch is required from everyone, and you hire people who are really excited to get into this industry, so you don't necessarily have to. It's not that you don't treat them with respect. It's that you can afford for people to you know,
you can chew people up and spit them out, and
you're going to have more people because there are so many people that are excited to work in games.
Yeah. Exactly. But if you don't like it, you can go and walk on because I've got 8 other people who are ready to take your place.
Yeah. And it's so not necessarily
you hunker down and you work hard and late, or someone else will. And that's the thing. And it's a question of, do you want that life? Don't you want that life? And that's the thing. People look at the games industry and they look at it as fun. You know, playing games all day. Not really.
Yeah.
You know, also, you look at a fantastic company like Blizzard. You know, I always say to work at Blizzard is a phenomenal gift up until your game gets cancelled and you realize that those countless years that you probably put in not seeing your family, they decided that that wasn't good enough. And we've chucked out that product and that now is in the bin and no one will see or enjoy what you put your heart and soul into.
You know,
but if you want to succeed, you've got to put your heart and soul into the next thing as well and hope that that one pays off.
I would go even farther. You know, I worked for Blizzard in Europe, so it's not HQ, but for a few years. And I have no doubt that this is one of the best gaming companies to work for. It is a fantastic work environment. People are awesome. People are, you know, friendly. But just like any other company, and I'm saying this because there was a tweet that made the rounds from Telltale employee that said, you know, I worked so hard and now I get nothing. And he was very disappointed in the way, like, companies in general, and maybe especially in the gaming industry, have a tendency of making you feel like they're your friends and you owe them your loyalty and your not your life, but, you know, you owe them efforts. And of course, you have to do the job that you're paid to do and you have to do it well and you have to be dedicated. But it doesn't mean it should take over your life or emotionally take you over. And I think it's very easy for games to have that effect. And the gaming industry, because, you know, we're all gamers and we all love it and we do it because we love it. Because if we didn't love it, we wouldn't do it. Yeah, sure. It's true to an extent, but it doesn't mean the company loves you. And just like I love Blizzard as a gamer and I think it's an awesome company and they make awesome games, they're still a company and their goal is to make money. And it's the same with your relationship as an employee. It can be a great company to work for and you can be a great employee, but you're still an employee and they're a company. And it's the same, I think, for every company in the industry, especially other companies. I think, as I mentioned, Blizzard is probably a very good example of how to do things right. And there are worse examples in every industry, especially in the gaming industry. But it's disheartening to see people dedicate themselves to something like this and then get nothing for it. In my case, I was very happy with the way things went, and I was very glad, you know, for the way things ended. I think it's so easy to not be into that situation. And so talking about labor laws, and I mean, apparently there's a class action lawsuit being levied against Telltale because they broke labor laws. So it's not even just about unions, but I do wonder if it isn't time that the gaming industry unionizes. And starts to, I know it's a bad word in the US, unions are a bad word, and certainly it can be problematic.
Yeah.
But it's also important for workers to have a voice that can carry a little bit of weight. And that's what unions are.
Yeah, exactly. To understand that actually, if you have the best interests of each other at heart, that is in everyone's best interest. And, you know, unions can go too far. And it's stuff like, you know, I love America, land of the free. And you go over there and you're not actually allowed to do anything because that's a union job. Oh, no, you can't move that. You've got to have someone from the union come along and do that. That's their job. You can't do that yourself. And it's like, oh, wow. Okay. Crazy. And it's so unions are, though, useful in that they look after everyone's best interests and they keep everyone, you know, happy and sustained, ideally. But it, I don't know. Industry is still a very, very young industry.
That's true.
Very young, and it's just, you know, we need to figure out how to do things best. You know, it's like the data shows the more diverse a game development team is, the better the products produced are, like financially. So actually, it doesn't matter if you're, you know, kind of super liberal or not, you want to have as many different genders and ethnicities and sexualities on your dev team, because the data proves you make more money. It's a more successful business.
I think this is the genius.
Thing, I think with workers as well. If we can prove that actually keeping your development team happy and you know, like longer lasting kind of abilities by not burning them out as much, that will be the way.
It's really, you know, the genius of Blizzard is that they figured out the way to make the most money is to make the best games. And it certainly has worked out for them pretty well. So I don't know. I mean, it can be, there can be some mutually beneficial relationships in every aspect of this, but we're not.
Even then, you look
experts,
at Blizzard, and Blizzard aren't experts. The amount of you know, big, long-lasting members of the Blizzard development teams that have been, you know, on the box almost in terms of their name and their brand and their contributions, who have become disenfranchised with the company and have moved on. I don't think anyone is perfect. I don't think that exists. And I think the human desire to constantly move on and discover new things and try new things, I think it's just Blizzard does a very good job of keeping people as happy as they can do so far. I've heard allegations that Blizzard is a real boys' club. And that if you're not in with the elite guys at the top, you're going to get nowhere. They have so many people. Historically, Blizzard didn't used to pay very well because they didn't need to.
Yeah, I remember that changed. On the gender thing, they're really making a huge effort in bringing up a lot of women, including, you know, in communications and in it's very visible. And on the work thing, on the pay thing, I remember I was there and I had been there for a couple of years where we had a pay adjustment because they brought us in line with the standards of the industry. And we were paid a little bit less because it was Blizzard. So there were efforts that were made in that, and it was...
But the reason that happened wasn't because someone at the top suddenly had a pang of conscience. It was that their talent was getting poached by all these other people who were like, yeah, I get that they're really nice and they give you a shield and a sword and they'll get you some free food from time to time. We'll do that as well. And we'll pay you more money because there's a lot of money in games. Mm. And so Blizzard was like, holy moly, we can't just rely on the fact that we're really nice guys to work for. We also need to be, you know, baseline matching everyone as well. Mm. And that's where competition bred a better work life. And I think if people can do that and say, like, yeah, you can work at Telltale and they make some great products, but they will work you into the ground, or you can work here. We make great products. We'll pay you the same. We'll do all the rest, but we'll also give you time off to spend with your family. We don't do crunch, or we have a crunch limit or whatever. There will be things that people will be able to do that mean that talent will move to the better options. And the more people that do that, if that's how they attract people to their position, everyone has to up their levels just to compete with that talent pool of trying to get people to work at their studios.
So what we're saying is you don't need unions. What you need to do is try to implement every possible way of making the most money possible, which means you will not crunch people into quitting. You will have an enjoyable work environment, and that's how you make the most money possible. So that's an easy solution, and unions aren't needed. Likely. Also, you need to have the smartest developers and artists and everything, and give them a lot of time to make something good, but not so much that you waste your money on divas. It's not easy. I'm
it
happy.
It really isn't. If it was, everyone would be doing it.
Isn't everyone already doing it, kind of, though?
Everyone's trying, but I mean, doing it well. You know, the fact is that, you know, you can name the companies that do it well on one hand, and so it shows that it is not an easy thing to do.
Well, we could discuss that for a very long time, yeah. But we won't. We're going to move on and talk about a couple of little very quick things. Microsoft is enabling mouse and keyboard on the Xbox, but only for some games, the games that want to implement it in the way that they want. So it's not like you're suddenly, because that would be a big problem. We talked about it with Destiny. If you can play against someone who is using mouse and keyboard, and you're using your controller, you're going to get destroyed. So it just means that those who want to, and for maybe different applications, you're going to have mouse and keyboard support, finally. Microsoft is also organizing an event called XO18 on November 11. So this is something that had existed in the, I think, Xbox 360 years, and they had abandoned it. They did it a few times. I would be curious to see if they already start announcing some of the games that their newly acquired studios are working on. That would be good.
It'd be pretty cool.
Xbox One S, there's a bundle with Fortnite exclusives, which now means there are exclusive stuff for all three competitors, meaning all three console manufacturers. There's a bundle for the Switch, for the PS4, and for the Xbox. Fortnite is everywhere. That also is not that surprising, but it's funny to see that they each have their own bundle, with the Xbox One having an Xbox skin. So you can get that if you want.
All the kids in the playground obviously are going to be, oh man, they can't wait to get that Xbox game.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, talking about Blizzard, World of Warcraft Classic is going to be available.
Playable.
At BlizzCon and at home. I think so. As I made no secrets about, I'm not really excited about World of Warcraft Classic. All of the retro things don't really interest me. We mentioned it with the retro consoles earlier. But the really cool thing is that BlizzCon, the virtual ticket that you pay for, of course, to have the conferences and some goodies.
$50.
As BlizzCon is happening, $50, the price has gone up. I have to buy it. I haven't bought it yet. This will enable you to play World of Warcraft Classic, which is going to be playable on the show floor at BlizzCon. So you're going to be able to play at home what is going to be playable on the show floor. The idea of this is awesome. And if they announce a Diablo product, a new Diablo game, and if they have a demo of it, as they always do for a new game that's coming out, imagine if you could play it at home.
That would be really cool. I don't know if they will. Obviously, they're talking about that you'll be able to download and play this classic Warcraft experience.
World of Warcraft Classic. Which
would be, starting experiences on Horde and Alliance in one zone. The thing is, it's tricky. If it's just Warcraft Classic, it's cool that they're doing it. And it's like, oh, this makes sense. You have a build. It's on all the PCs at the convention. You can actually allow people to play that build at home. It's a limited, truncated build, so it's not like someone can unpack it and discover the whole game necessarily. That seems like a cool thing to do. At the same time, it's a 15-year-old game that I've bought before several times. I've paid for. Continued.
I guess it's different from a new game, is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just like, why have you got to buy the virtual ticket to play this demo experience? And it's tricky because in some ways they're adding additional value to the virtual ticket, which in and of itself has a load of in-game items, all access to all the streams. You know, there's a huge amount of value in that. But now they're gating something which I feel entitled to. As a lifelong Warcraft player, have I got to spend an extra $50 to play this demo?
I think
I bought the game. I have the game.
Yeah, but this is not released. This is not released.
This is Warcraft.
Listen, this is classic. BlizzCon virtual ticket. So you're virtually getting the experience that people are getting at BlizzCon.
Yeah.
It's not a game that is... Well, you are going. I'm not.
But the thing is
I think
it's cool, but at the same time, I think it's the wrong product to do it with. I think if this was Diablo 4 and they said, here you go, and virtual ticket holders, load up your launcher now because you can start downloading and streaming and playing this game right now.
Well, this is what I want. This is what I'm excited
exactly.
about.
That's
World
really
of Warcraft
cool.
Classic is meh, but Diablo 4, and by the way, if they do that, imagine how many people are going to be buying the virtual ticket just to play it for those 2 or 3 days when BlizzCon is happening nonstop. Like, they would, this would be the biggest gaming heist.
They literally would sell exactly a demo. $50 a go for a demo. Like, if you did but that,
it's probably like a 20 minutes experience if that even happens, right?
But you would straight up do it. And the opening ceremony is free to watch. They can stream it on their launcher so everyone knows about it, who's around at the time. Everyone's there talking about it. Go out, get a ticket out, get it now. Why, man? I don't care. You get to play Diablo 4 now. Like, you got the demos there. You know, like, that would be insane. And that was then, again, changes the whole paradigm around demos. Like, hang on, we can, you know, you're doing a free beta for your new mode on Black Ops 4. That's cute. We're doing a $50 come and play our game for 20 minutes experience thing. Like, that's when you start thinking, like, okay, they've won. And again, if it was Diablo 4, I wouldn't even feel bad about that. Mm-hmm. I would not feel bad about dropping $50 purely to play that game for a bit and experience it. Holy moly.
That would be, I mean, it's absolutely, that's what, you know, Red Dead Redemption online heist is. It's BlizzCon selling you $50 virtual tickets to play Diablo. It's literally a holdup of gamers, you know, pulling out their wallets and shoving the money in Blizzard's face. And of course, you would get a beta after that, a closed beta, an open beta. I have no doubt about it. This is really BlizzCon. But yeah, I would be, and we know we're going to get a Diablo something at BlizzCon. There's no way it's not going to happen. So anyway, we'll see what goes on there. If you have any inside information, let me know. You know, use Telegram, secret DM. I won't leak it, I promise.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Excellent. Just going to leave a package next to a trash can in your local park and start searching through that.
No, just it's easier. Just, you know, you text me a winky emoji that means yes, and a poop means no.
Okay.
All right, excellent.
A winky poop, though. What does that mean? No one
a winky
knows.
Poop. I'll have to guess. All right. Well, that is it for our episode of Pixels. Thank you so much for joining me and sharing your love of Destiny 2 Forsaken.
Oh, thank you.
I'm sure
I spent an hour and a half talking to you rather than playing Destiny 2 Forsaken. Nothing says love more than that.
That I am actually quite proud.
But I've highlighted to you as well that you're like, oh shit, I could have been playing Destiny this whole time. Yeah, exactly.
Well, my baby was crying, so actually I could have been playing Destiny. It doesn't matter. No, he really started crying at some point, and obviously my wife is here. So it's okay if you didn't hear it. It's fine. I shouldn't have mentioned it. I would have appeared to be an adequate father. Hey, you have stuff that you do on the internet. Would you share that with people listening?
Yes, I am over on Twitter, @_T, where I tweet at least 3 times a week, so stay tuned.
Excellent. That sounds very exciting. @_T on Twitter. I am Not Patrick on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and you can find this show at frenchspin.com. Frenchspin.com, of course, you will find also the show notes, and, well, not a lot of show notes, but if you want to comment, you can do that there. You'll find other shows and links to other shows there as well. And if you like Blizzard games, you might want to listen to the Icy Veins podcast, which I do with the team at Icy Veins every couple of weeks. That is a quick recap of all the news from all the Blizzard games, or The Instance, which we do with Scott Johnson and Terpster when he can be bothered to show up, and Garrett Weintraub as well. Also, I'm guessing you might know about that one, so you can listen to that as well, and we will be back in a couple of weeks with another show when we're going to be talking about, who knows, gaming news. That will be awesome. Talk to you then. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.